Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program, South Africa's unemployment rate dips to 31.4%, but nearly half the workforce remains under strain. I'll be talking to the Statistician General in just a moment. Electricity reform enters a make-or-break phase as government shifts from promises to execution. Changes to the proposed Credit Act spark debate. Will borrowing get cheaper or simply harder to access? And Africa's creative economy takes center stage at an upcoming conference aiming to reshape the continent's future. It's Wednesday, the 18th of February. Now, you'll know that South Africa's official unemployment rate has edged down to 31.4%. That's the lowest level in more than 5 years. Now, on the surface, that looks like real progress, but I think the deeper data might tell us a more complex story. Discouraged job seekers are rising, youth unemployment remains painfully high, and the broader measure of labour underutilisation still sits around 44%. So is this a real turning point in the jobs crisis or just statistical relief? I'm in conversation now with the Statistician General, Risenga Maluleki. SG, a very warm welcome to you. So the unemployment rate falling to 31.4%, as I mentioned, but is this genuine job creation or simply people leaving the labour force? What's the assessment here?
Well, we are seeing two measures that have made this unemployment rate to decline. One, increase in the number of people that are employed. And of course, a decrease as well in the number of the unemployed who are actively looking for employment. So let us look over the past three quarters, maybe all the four quarters of 2025. Coming back from 2024, we had recovered some jobs. But what happened in the first quarter, almost all those jobs that we had recovered were wiped out, because the highest we got in 2024 was in quarter three, where we saw a growth by 294,000 jobs. And indeed, in the first quarter, we lost 291,000 jobs. But after that, we have been recovering. Second, third, and fourth quarter have shown and seen recoveries in jobs, which have made us go beyond the 17 million mark of the employed people. So we're currently sitting at 17.1 million people who are employed. Having said so, the number of people that are unemployed but actively looking for employment, who help us to compute unemployment rate, the headline unemployment rate, at some stage we were sitting at 8.4 million. We dropped down to 8.2 million and stayed too long around that space. We have now dropped to 7.8 million, so below the 8 million mark. So in terms of the rate, this is the second quarter in a row that we see the rate starting to decline. But when we look at the numbers, the absolute numbers, it looks like we're starting to see a drop. And of course, our job is to measure, it's not to speculate. So we are still going to see what is going to happen in the first quarter of 2026.
Let me ask you this. Formal sector jobs rising by 320,000, but there's been a sharp drop in informal jobs. Is this structural improvement or economic strain, do you think, in the informal economy? How do you read that?
Well, usually what we see is informal sector does fluctuate from time to time. But I don't want us to read the informal sector alone. I want us to look at the industries that have lost or shedded jobs. Trade shedded 98,000 jobs. And of course, we lost other jobs in manufacturing as well as in mining. But particularly in trade, we have seen a lot of jobs being lost from the informal sector. We know that Gauteng accounts for about 33%, sometimes up to 35% of our share of nominal GDP. The city of Joburg does have a big share in terms of our employment and unemployment numbers, depending on which direction it goes. So what happened, particularly in the informal sector, is that in the lead up and indeed during the G20 summit, a lot of informal traders that didn't meet the prescripts of the city of Joburg were removed from the streets. And this has contributed greatly in the informal sector, declining by about 293,000 jobs in the all, including what would have happened in other provinces.
Let me pick you up on a geographic point, if I can. Gauteng losing 54,000 jobs. The Western Cape has gained 93,000. This must be a clear indication, surely, of a provincial economic divergence, which is only set to grow.
Certainly, our provinces have a lot of diversity in them. Amongst other issues that you see, say, in the province of the Western Cape, the structure of the Western Cape economy is that you see finance being strong, you see agriculture, and of course, you see also utilities or transport, but not as much as strong as you would see in finance and agriculture. Whereas in Gauteng, for example, you don't see much of agriculture. You actually see more of finance, which is the strongest that we see in the province. So that diversity plays a role. And when you look at the gains that we have seen in the Western Cape, we see agriculture has gained and indeed finance has gained. So they did also contribute what we see in gains of the Western Cape, whereas the losses of Gauteng, we have already touched on them in relation to the informal sector in the trade industry. Now, these numbers are not a way to say we are going to see them go this way. There are times where we have seen the Western Cape lose employment and other provinces gaining employment. But just as an addition, one of the things that we see when we talk about the Western Cape, other than the fact that it has been the one that has the lowest unemployment rate, headline unemployment rate, as well as what we used to call expanded unemployment rate being low, in this quarter, fourth quarter of 2025, it has fallen below the 20% mark, sitting at 18.1% headline.
Just a final question, and perhaps the most worrying aspect, I think, of the survey is that youth unemployment ticking up to 44%, despite the overall improvement. This recovery, it would suggest, does exclude young people, and if that trajectory continues, it becomes even more concerning for the country.
Young people have always been vulnerable to labor markets. So are women. Particularly when we go back to young people, it's even worse when they are female, because they become a little more vulnerable than their male counterparts. But for more than a decade, we have seen the unemployment rate of young people being higher, and I'm talking about 15 to 34 years, being higher than the national average, whereas for those 35 years to 64, it has been far lower than the national average. Having said so, if we look at the number of young people just 15 to 24 years, regardless of where they are, we have 10.3 million of them. Out of the 10.3 million, 3.5 million are not in employment, education, or training, retaining a NEET rate of 34%. When you move to a 34-year cut, we are talking about 20 million of those in our population. And of course, we are hitting in the excess of 9 million, about 9.8 million young people in that 15 to 34 who are not in employment, right, education or training. Much more difficult when it is they are female. So indeed, young people are vulnerable to labor markets.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Risenga Maluleke, who is the Statistician General. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's electricity reform has moved from promises to implementation, with private investment, as I understand it, rising, load shedding, of course, all but gone, and a new wholesale market is on the horizon. All well and good. But a new report is warning that momentum could stall unless government locks in pricing reform, grid expansion, Eskom restructuring, and market rules with a degree of urgency. That's a big list. So I think the question is now a simple one. Are we truly building a competitive electricity market, or are we still stuck in the weeds of transition? I want to talk about this with André Nepgen, who is Chief Executive Officer of the Renewable Energy Platform Discovery Green. André, welcome. You say reform is now about execution. That makes sense. But what do you think is specifically still blocking delivery?
I think when we say it's about intent and execution, I think incredible work has been done to date. You know, I think you mentioned the, you know, load shedding. What the Department of Energy and Electricity has done has been absolutely remarkable. And the aim of this report is to build on that momentum, to really say that we should not rest for a second and keep on going and keep on pushing. And the report is basically the view. It was written by Crutham and endorsed by the South African Energy Traders Association and commissioned by them. And it basically lists out a number of points to encourage, you know, or basically give a view of what a part of the market, a big part of the market, is seeing as important to double down on. And that's really what it is about. And it lists 10 things, and I can go through them.
We can go through some of those in just a moment, but I just want to ask you about one broad end goal. If Eskom's unbundling is the biggest reform since 1994, why is the end state still not clearly defined? In other words, what we're aiming for?
So while the ERA Act sort of defines that, you know, there needs to be separation to allow for a competitive market, you know, recently there's also been a little bit of uncertainty around what does the end state look like. You know, it's not as simple as saying, you know, three independent entities. You have to consider the assets, you have to consider the state and the roles and responsibilities. So having a clear view of that is, I think, very valuable from an investor and a private sector point of view. And that's really what we're pushing for.
But we can't realistically launch a wholesale electricity market, surely, without first fixing transmission constraints. And that remains a big issue, a big problem, doesn't it?
No, I don't actually think you can't. I mean, transmission is absolutely critical for the IRP, the Minister's long-term plan for resources in South Africa. That is what it is for. But it doesn't mean that they are dependent on each other. The wholesale energy market allows for, you know, people to buy electricity in a competitive bid offer-based environment, which is great for driving efficiencies and competition and lowering the cost of energy. What the transmission would actually do is just increase the supply, which will result in more, which I think is a good thing. We need both, and I think the launch of the wholesale energy market, hopefully this year, needs to happen regardless.
The report, as I understand it, calls for what is termed cost-reflective tariffs. Explain that to me. Does it mean electricity prices will go up before they come down?
No, it doesn't mean that necessarily. What currently has been in tariffs across South Africa is, you pay a single fee, and the reason why that worked back in the day is because you only had one place to buy electricity from, and hence it used to happen. In a competitive market, you have different role players. You know, you have balancing parties, people who provide stability to grids, all these other functions. And currently, the tariff don't necessarily reflect that. And this has sort of been, I think, rightfully Eskom's concern in the market to say, listen, if it's a competitive environment in which to compete in, we need to ensure that the pricing policy The split of tariffs, you know, that every single party is adequately and appropriately compensated. It needs to happen. And I think that is in motion this year, and that needs to be bedded down, because it gives a signal to the market to say, and for the following functions, this is what the market's willing to compensate for, and then we can prioritize investment.
How bankable do you think power projects are if pricing policy is still not 100% finalized?
It definitely slows it down. I think, you know, there's a bit of concern around it. You know, currently, you know, the way the tariffs are currently, it sort of encourages actually bankability on that. But, you know, if anyone has a bit of concern of where it could go, that level of uncertainty just creates a bit of paralysis that we're trying to avoid here. So projects are still being banked. Momentum is still there. But I think, you know, giving clarity and certainty around that, even though the tariffs will change, will just accelerate it.
And Andre, you'll concede that municipal distribution all over the country does remain fragile. I think that's a given. So the question is wheeling at scale possible under the current system and constraint?
So, there's currently, and I think everyone's acutely aware of this, significant debt to Eskom, north of 100 billion. Rand that is owed to Eskom due to, you know, municipalities not paying for the energy that Eskom delivered. That's a big problem, because on the one side, you know, you want to give access to everyone around the country. You want to give everyone access to renewable energy. But at the same time, you know, you've got to be sympathetic and understanding that Eskom needs to be able to recoup the funds owed to it in order to keep the system going. So that sort of balance has been absolutely, you know, finding a solution there that allows for people to access a competitive market for electricity while ensuring that the debt gets repaid is critical, and that needs to be defined and sorted.
So let me finish with a catch-all, if I can. Momentum has improved, as you referenced, considerably since load shedding eased. That's a good thing. But what do you see as the single biggest risk that could derail this reform in the short term?
Sure. The biggest one, really, I think what is very important and the sort of the big focus now is, and I mentioned earlier, it's moving from intent to execution, which I think is going to happen. And this is the report is in support of that. In particular, transmission. I think that is very important, because the ability, South Africa's got some of the best wind and solar resources in the world. We could be competing at much lower cost of energy than a global scale. So we need, and the plan is there, it needs to keep going. It needs to be accelerated, ideally, is to build up the transmission infrastructure, because if that happens, I think a lot of the other concerns get addressed as a result.
Well, no doubt 2026 is an important year. Andre Nepkin, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of Discovery Green. Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in last week's State of the Nation address, President Ramaphosa announcing plans to amend the National Credit Act to make credit more accessible for women and youth-led businesses. It's a move, I think, aimed at boosting inclusion and entrepreneurship. That's a good thing. But is the current regulatory framework, particularly interest rate caps and pricing rules, actually locking low-income South Africans out of formal credit and pushing them towards unregulated lenders? That is a problem. Well, I want to talk in a little more detail about this with Brett van Asverken, Chief Executive Officer of the short-term loan company Wonga. And let's discuss whether the proposed amendments go far enough and what real financial inclusion looks like in practice. So, Brett, welcome. Let's start with the basics. What exactly in the current National Credit Act makes it hard for low-income or youth-led businesses to access formal credit? It can often be a very tough road.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy. So in the current regulatory framework, there's probably two components that are problematic. The one is that particularly for what we're talking about, youth and women-led SME development, the current Credit Act requires us to follow procedures in obtaining proof of income. And, you know, in principle, for a formally employed individual, that's absolutely fine. And these are very much sort of first world type of approaches to credit granting, and they work well for a portion of our market. However, we are a two-tier economy where we have a lot of the people in our country who are in more of an informal market, and therein these regulations don't work very well, because trying to go and be able to prove and validate the consumer's income, which is a requirement on us as credit providers, makes it actually very, very difficult to do when you're dealing with somebody who is, you know, what we kind of anecdotally calling an everyday earner. So there's definitely a barrier there, and that creates a structural barrier for us to be able to advance credit into these markets, because we then face the scrutiny of the credit regulator, who will come and validate what we've done, and we can lose our credit license if we're found to be lending recklessly. The second part of this is around pricing. So the pricing caps that we've got in place today are structured into an interest rate, but then also a fee-based revenue stream for us. And the fees are there to cover things like, you know, opening up the account and, you know, doing all the validations you need to do, bureau checks, paying all the costs that are associated with funding the loan, paying the money into their account, doing all the collections, etc. Now, those fees were last amended in 2015. So that's been now 11 years ago. And not only have you got the impact of inflation, which on a compounded basis is north of 55% increase in cost, but you've also got a lot of new regulations that have come into effect. You know, things like FICA, Papier, there's been a whole shift in the way debit orders are processed, for instance, with the introduction of debit check. And those costs have doubled, you know, so there's very real cost pressure on credit providers in keeping up with the cost of granting the credit and the compliance requirements and the fees that you're able to recover. Now, unfortunately, what then ends up happening when you've got a cap on your fee revenue and you've got increasing costs, the only thing we're able to actually control in this process is the risk that we're taking. And if I use our company as one example, we found that 2 years ago, we had to stop lending to first-time credit users in the market because their risk profile was such that the amount of money, we couldn't cover the cost of the lending that we were making. We're actually losing money on those customers. And right now, we're now faced with actually having to cut out certain income groups, lower income groups, because again, we lose money when we're granting credit to certain groups. We can't make it affordable to be able to lend there. So that creates another structural barrier. So, you know, what you've seen at a market level is, if I had to talk about the NCR stats that they release every quarter, what we're seeing at the moment is that application volumes across the industry have now gone up to the order of about 13 million credit applications per quarter. But the number of applications that are being granted are sitting at around 5.5 million a quarter. So our question is, what happens to the other 8 million consumers who are being declined? Well, we know the answer. They're going into the informal market where they're paying 50% per month on their interest is their borrowing costs per month that they're having to pay.
So, Brett, let me come back to pricing then. The suggestion would be then that it should reflect the actual cost of capital and risk. In simple terms, what would that mean for a person then taking out a short-term loan?
So we've done the numbers, and, you know, when we've, in our presentations to the DTIC and to the National Credit Regulator, what we've shown is that we think we can get back to approval rates in the market back where they were. Sorry, what I wanted just to mention is that the inverse of approval is your rejection rate. And the rejection rates over the last 10 years have moved from around 50 to 55%. They're now topping over 72%. So you can see this isn't just a Wonga story. This is an industry story. What we've proposed to them is that there is simply an inflation adjustment to the fees over time. What this would translate to, you know, if you were looking at a loan, average loan of around 3,000 Rand, we calculated that would add approximately 49 Rand to the monthly installment for a consumer. But what you're then doing is you're opening up access to many millions of consumers able to access the formal markets, and their actual savings that they would be making would be substantial, because instead of paying 50% per month, they would be paying, you know, whatever the rates are across the different credit types in that are in offer in the in the marketplace, but it would certainly be substantially lower than what they're paying in the informal market.
So let me ask you a final question then. If government amends the Act, as the President has suggested, to improve access for young entrepreneurs and women, is there a practical change or changes that you would like to see written into law?
So there's probably two steps to this. One is that there's regulations that could be amended and published very quickly and easily. And we know that they have all the information they need to do that right now. The change to rates and fees could take effect pretty quickly, and I think that would have an immediate impact to economic activity. So we've calculated that we think that the response to getting the rejection rate back closer to the 55% mark would increase access to credit in the formal market of roughly 350 billion rand per year. So, you know, that's just the immediate credit impact. But then think about the economic impact and the multiplier effect as that goes into the economy, into jobs, into tax, etc. That would be my first port of call. I think the second port is actually looking at the Credit Act in its entirety and starting to look at a process where we would engage with the relevant stakeholders to say, what do we need to do to make this practically possible to be able to advance credit into things for developmental purposes, as what President Ramaphosa is suggesting. I would certainly look at the income requirements, because I think that is a structural requirement. But I know that there are a number of other things that would help this take better shape.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. Brett van Aswegen, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer at Wonga, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Africa's creative economy is often celebrated for its energy and originality, but behind the headlines, I think the industry is facing real pressure, from shrinking budgets to platform dominance and uneven monetization. Sandra Gordon is the founding partner and director of the Pulse Media Conference and joins me now to explain why this gathering upcoming matters now and whether it's actually confronting the industry's toughest problems or simply showcasing its brightest moments. Sandra, this event, and we'll talk about it in just a moment, comes at a critical juncture, but let me start with the uncomfortable part. What, in your opinion, are the key structural problems that are facing South Africa's creative and media industry right now?
I think there are three key ones, Jeremy. Thank you very much for having me on your show. The first is that I don't think that the industry at large is viewed as the most exciting, creative and lucrative career place that I think you and I both experienced when we were younger. And if they are we then developing and retaining that talent and creating emerging leaders? It seems that there are gaps there. The second thing is technology and how AI will affect. It's not just AI, it's technology in general. We haven't come to grips yet about whether technology is to be embraced or ignored or just challenged. So I think it's going to be positive and negative, and that's the solution we want to propose, and the speakers will touch on that.
The third element, go ahead.
Is governance. We believe there's a lot more that could be done to strengthen ethical standards and prevent misconduct and protect integrity across the industry. And I'm talking from marketing right through media and advertising. It's a biggie at the moment.
So let me pick you up on two of those important issues. One, Sandra, how big is the talent drain, do you think, to global firms and distributed teams? And if it's onerous, what do you think it means for local agencies who are trying to compete on what is seemingly an uneven playing field?
It's nothing terribly new. I just think that people haven't really looked at it as something that was bad. It's always happened. It's been happening, I would suggest, for about the last two decades at least, that big agencies, global agencies came in. In fact, it's even longer than that. And took their picks and then merged them into their own environments. And for some, it was not at all compatible. And they left the industry. So it's the leaders that leave. And the overseas companies were left behind with the middle and lower levels. And they soon realized that that was problematical, but they were more concentrated on what they were doing globally than just locally. So it did have a big impact in the beginning, and then things settled down. But they recently rejigged things. So there's a lot more of them with a lot more power coming in, and it's really started a lot of people being squeezed out of leadership positions within media agencies in particular. I'm not talking so much about advertising agencies. They seem to have dealt with it a bit differently. So that is having an impact. And those are the people that we would have relied on in the past to develop future talent.
Into that vacuum is stepping artificial intelligence, Sandra, which is disrupting production and strategy and many other aspects of the mix. Do you think that African firms are investing fast enough, or are we now at serious risk of falling behind?
No, I don't think we're at serious risk. I'm talking about specifically about the environment that I know, which is marketing, advertising, and media. One of our key speakers is Michael Jordan, the well-known entrepreneur, ex-FNB head. He's recently invested, amongst other companies, into a business that's brought in AI that pretty much wipes out the amount of people that are involved in the whole media planning process. A colleague of mine pointed out that what used to take him a month or two to produce a media plan, a substantial media plan, can now take him 3 or 4 days with the help of AI. Mm. So what are the ramifications of that? Jordan's view, I think, is that that money that was previously spent on a whole lot of additional stuff that maybe is not necessary that AI takes place now, he's saying that should be put back into the budgets to ensure that creativity is developed, which is another area I think we've suffered in horribly over the last 3 or 4 decades, where South Africa was, as you know, award-winning advertising produced on a regular basis. Mm. And that's calmed down quite a lot, I would say, in the last 10 years or so. And a lot of blame has been placed at not having sufficient budgets. And he's suggesting that maybe that's where that place should take place. I think it should be.
Sandra, give me the logistics of the event itself, and beyond inspiration, what measurable outcomes should attendees expect after attending the conference?
It's taking place on the 26th of February, which is next Thursday. It's at the Galleria in Sandton. We're running out of tickets at the moment, which is very encouraging because we thought it's quite a difficult time of year for the industry, but they've stepped up to the plate. What we want to achieve is to address the rapid change across marketing and media and bring senior talent together with candid discussions on leadership, ethics, technology, and developing the next generation. If we achieve even half of that, I think we'll have made great inroads into what is facing an industry that has always been very resilient and thought-provoking.
And the idea at the end of it, one imagines, is that practical solutions will emerge that will help agencies and independent creators survive in what you've outlined is a very difficult and changing, fast-changing paradigm.
Quite. If we haven't achieved that, then we haven't really done what we intended to do when we founded the business.
Well, the event is called the Pulse Media Conference. I've been in conversation with founding partner and director Sandra Gordon. Sandra, good luck and thank you very much. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.